Welcome back to the Global Greek Influence, the podcast that takes you on a journey through the dynamic world of global Greeks in the realms of technology, cutting-edge scientific and engineering innovation, entrepreneurship and business, also special topics on politics and history. I'm your hostess, Panayiotou Poumenidou, and I'm thrilled to have you join us once again. If you want to stay updated and never miss an episode, make sure to subscribe, like, and review the Global Greek Influence podcast on your favorite podcasting platform, such as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, and more. Your support means the world to me. For even more engagement, be sure to follow our podcast's Twitter account, Facebook page, and LinkedIn page. It is the best way to stay up to date with the latest episodes, connect with me directly, and even suggest topics you would love to explore. But wait, there is more. For just €2 and 99 cents a month, you can unlock a world of exclusive content. By becoming a premium subscriber, you will gain access to exclusive video episodes available only on Spotify, get sneak peeks of upcoming interviews, and enjoy special episodes that dive deep into fascinating topics. So get ready to immerse yourself in the captivating stories and influential figures that have shaped the global Greek influence and impact the world today. Join us on this exciting journey of discovery and celebration. Thank you for being part of the Global Greek Influence community. Today we have the privilege to be with Stefan Irig. His name resonates with the academic community and beyond. His groundbreaking research and insightful analysis have shed light on the intricate connections between history, ideology, and the human experience. As a professor of history at the University of Haifa and the director of the Haifa Center for German and European Studies in Israel, he has dedicated his career to unraveling the complex tapestry of European and Middle Eastern history. Stefan Irig has embarked on a quest to challenge conventional wisdom and expose the entangled relationships that have shaped our world. His thought-provoking work has not only reshaped our understanding of history, but has also pushed the boundaries of academic research. Stefan Irig's contributions to the field of history extend beyond his books. As a sought-after speaker, he has shared his insights and research with audiences around the world. His ability to connect historical events to contemporary issues has made him a captivating presence on the global stage. Join us today as we explore the remarkable Stefan Irig and his mind, delving into the depths of his research, his perception, his perspectives on history, and the impact his work has had on the way we understand the world through genocide and denying genocide, the factor of illiberal democratic leaders with efficient leadership environments, the factor of fascination with totalitarian historical figures in the nation's founding principles. Welcome to the show, Stefan.
Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure to have you with us today. Could you tell us what inspired and motivated you to research and expand your research expertise in genocide?
So there are basically two answers here. The first one is the more general one. Genocide is the big question mark that hovers over history. Why do people kill in such a fashion? And also, why do they kill in such a fashion again and again throughout modern history, especially? The other is much more down to earth and relates to my research. So I was researching on the Nazis and Turkey. And while carrying out my research, not only did I realize there is here an intrinsic connection to the Armenian genocide as well, even though it happened before, there is this other big question. We have assumed for a long time, or we had assumed, that interwar Germany, interwar Europe didn't know a lot about the Armenian genocide, and that this basically ignorance helped make the Nazis and the Holocaust possible. That's the one part of it. The other part of it is that German knowledge about the Armenian genocide today, in the past decades or in the past century, was rather limited. And this didn't quite sit well with me, because we do know, on the other hand, that Germany was quite important in the late Ottoman Empire. So as I went along with my research, I found out that there are these connections, that Germany was very much involved and that Germany knew a lot about what was going on during World War I and also in the decades before. And that actually the dynamic is totally different. It's upside down in a way from what we used to think about this period. Germany knew a lot and the Nazis also knew a lot. And this actually was part of the prehistory of the Holocaust.
In the realm of political leadership, there exists a troubling phenomenon: illiberal democratic leaders who deny the occurrence of genocide. These individuals, while holding positions of power, not only perpetuate a deficient leadership environment, but also challenge the very foundations of truth, justice, and human dignity. How can we challenge the strategic advantage of illiberal democratic leaders who deny genocide in a deficient leadership environment?
So look, as a historian, it's not easy to give a blanket answer that fits to all such leaders in such environments. If we do talk about Turkey, which we might, then it's difficult. It's very tricky at the moment, I think. In the beginning of this century, in the 2000s, Turkey was opening itself up. I don't know if your listeners know that, but all the major works on the Armenian Genocide, for example, but also on Greek-Turkish history were translated into Turkish, were freely available everywhere. Turkish researchers were opening up the field, were interacting with our colleagues in Southeastern Europe and in the world. And then in the last 10 years, a little bit more than the last 10 years, the atmosphere really changed in Turkey, from also an opening on the Armenian and also on various Greek questions. A new kind of alliance was forged with the nationalists in Turkey, and now these topics are basically closed. That's the one thing. So it's a very closed field now inside of Turkey, but there is more. I believe that the way discourses in the political arena have been constructed in the last 10, 15 years in Turkey make it very difficult for us on the outside to actually talk about these topics with people in Turkey. And especially, you know, the question of challenging a leader who is playing with these topics and who's using such topics to actually, you know, consolidate his rule. It's very difficult from the outside. And a lot of times I feel that interventions from the outside will actually strengthen these people at this point in time. Why do I say that? I believe that actually one of the major shifts in the last 10, 15 years is not only towards nationalism, but it's a kind of victimization discourse. Where, you know, these outside interferences or, you know, insisting that genocide and past violences and crimes be acknowledged actually feed into this narrative, you know, of, you know, the Turks being actually being persecuted, victimized by the West, that the outside world doesn't understand us, you know, and that they're working all together against a free and democratic free society. It's a discourse we don't only find in Turkey. There is this new generation of populist autocrats all across the world. Putin uses very similar discourses. You know, it's also the West. He's also the only true defender of Christianity in Turkey, of Islam. So it's not the best time, basically, to intervene in these discourses from the outside, especially because the media, the media landscape is very limited in these societies. So what kind of a debate can we even, you know, hope to have? Where are our allies inside these countries who worked on these topics before and who were outspoken in the past? Can they now engage with us and help the topic and help themselves? I think at the moment, these are very difficult and trying times. When it comes to the Armenian Genocide, also for other Greek-Turkish issues, I'm afraid that the process is a little bit on ice at this moment. But it doesn't mean there is nothing for us to do. I mean, there is a growing community of scholars around the world, both Turkish, non-Turkish, also Greek, also Armenian, also many other nationalities who are working on interesting topics. If you look at publications of university presses in English in the last 10, 15 years, you see a true explosion of research in the late Ottoman Empire, various minority questions, questions of violence. This is quite an exciting field, actually. So while politics seems to be closed to us at the moment, in academia, a lot is going on.
It would be also very interesting to explore the history factor within the context of populations inhabiting these areas where we talk about minorities, because it seems even from genetic studies, I recently read a study on the Cell journal published by Elsevier, which is a high impact factor journal, which shows that essentially most of the populations, or it gives us a glimpse into 2000 BC, where it seems that populations were quite uniform, pretty much as they are today at the Eastern Mediterranean, whereas politics and religions have shaped a different landscape of what we see today as nations.
So yeah, I mean, this is one of the constants of modern history in Europe and in the world, you know, that we need to construct a nation, we need to construct an in-group and an out-group. And especially in, let's say, crisis situations of democracy or also non-democratic states, constructing and working on and vilifying the in or out group, you know, these are key mechanisms that, you know, there is little we can really do about in such a dialogue. I mean, the genetic and ethnic background of populations, to some degree, it basically doesn't really matter. It matters what people feel themselves to be. And that's already enough of a problem, you know, in the Eastern Mediterranean all around, isn't it?
Indeed, we live in quite a troublesome neighborhood in this world. You have explored the intriguing intersection between Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey, and the Nazi imagination. Through your book, Atatürk in the Nazi Imagination, you unravel the complex dynamics of admiration, inspiration, and ideological influence that shaped the perception of Atatürk within the Nazi regime. Modern Turkey, as we know it today, bears the deep-rooted imprint of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder and first president of the Republic of Turkey. Atatürk's vision, encapsulated in the ideology of Kemalism or Atatürkism, continues to shape the nation's identity and governing principles. His revolutionary policies and reforms have had a lasting impact on various aspects of Turkish society, including its treatment of minorities, expansionist ambitions, and even in the practices of subsequent leaders like Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Why do we see a shared fascination within totalitarian historical figures in a nation's founding principles?
So that is a rather big question, isn't it? Especially as there are many Atatürks, there isn't just the one. Used to be that you can walk around in Turkey and you can tell a little bit about the owner of an establishment by what kind of picture, portrait of Atatürk they have hung up. There was a more secular Atatürk, a more leftist Atatürk, a more rightist nationalist Atatürk, all different images. In the last 15 to 20 years, there has been a lot of redefining of the nation and also, you know, of what Atatürk stands for. There are different views. You know, the long view is basically that Atatürk ensured the continued existence of Turkey and ushered it into a modernized democratic kind of future. There are, of course, more critical views that look at the violence of the new Turkish Republic, of the Turkish War of Independence, of one-party rule that until, you know, after his death didn't lead to a multi-party democracy. It's all this big question of, you know, what do modernizing regimes look like? What basically do we want to remember of their time? How critical can we engage with them? And I think only an open and strong society can really go back and re-examine what, you know, the Atatürk period and also then the time after Atatürk, İsmet İnönü, what he stands for as well. And I do think, you know, there were times in the recent history of modern Turkey where there was a process of re-examining the past. But since Erdogan took over, Kemalists on the left, but also Kemalists on the nationalist right, kind of are clinging to their own Ataturk and vision of what Ataturk stands for. And there isn't a lot of room to maneuver and discuss. When my book first came out, it wasn't very, what do you say, special inside Turkey. It received good reviews from the left, from the right, also from Erdogan's own party. But, you know, as I said before, as new alliances were forged with the nationalists, as the secular part of society and the left became more endangered, so also this memory of Ataturk became more, you know, perceived to be endangered and more guarded and more defended. But it's not, it's of course not only Turkey. We have this in a lot of other contexts in Europe as well, that people from the interwar period, especially if there is foundational kind of aspects behind them, are glorified, and a lot of the negative parts or critical parts are ignored today. So, you know, in one, to one degree, you know, Turkey is special, and in another broader view, Turkey isn't so special at all, I would argue. Of course, you know, you have histories like the history of Germany where such things are totally taboo. You don't have much from the interwar period, you know, on offer. Modern Germany is trying to connect back to the Weimar Republic, but the Weimar Republic was, you know, complicated and dangerous enough as it was.
One understands that it's a little bit tricky to constructively criticize a historical period without really considering the conditions and the environment of a particular historical period. Of course, we see Germany has overcome such limitations in their history, while in other parts of the world, such limitations have not been overcome. In one of your most influential works, in the acclaimed book Justifying Genocide, Germany and the Armenians, From Bismarck to Hitler, you examine the strong connections between German politics, the Armenian genocide, and the rise of the Nazi regime. This meticulously researched and thoughtfully presented work has gained international recognition, highlighting the importance of understanding the past to navigate the challenges of the present. Why should we not see the phenomenon of Hitler in isolation as a result of synthesis and hybridization of the flow of ideas within a given historical context?
Well, on the one hand, myself as a historian, I was trained that, you know, everything is specific to time and place. These are the basic coordinates, you know, and comparison is very difficult. And you can do it, you know, certain points and crossroads, but it's difficult. It's always pears and apples or something like that. On the other hand, of course, you know, we do know that certain kind of hyper-nationalist movements share a lot of similarities across time and space. As I mentioned earlier, also applying to populist autocrats, there are certain themes and building blocks of discourse, you know, anti-minority, perhaps anti-Western, anti-democratic, that we can also see across time and space. And in very diverse society, in highly industrialized, in less industrialized, in more societies with a strong civil society foundation, in others where it's lacking. So, you know, there is something to learn across time and space. But, you know, the Nazis were so very special in regard to their trajectory and, you know, the kind of blanket of murder and genocide that they pulled over Europe, that it's very difficult to constructively compare others to the Nazis. That makes it a little bit difficult. And also in this context, I have to say, you know, the book on Ataturk as well as on the Armenian genocide, a lot of times it's received exactly in this kind of trajectory that people say, oh, so that means that, you know, the Young Turks or Ataturk were like the Nazis, which is not part of these books at all. What I'm trying to reconstruct is the timeline, basically. You know, people had knowledge of something, people were influenced, people engaged with something, you know, and from this you go from basically year to year, from era to era, and see what they carry with them and how it, you know, influences future thought and actions.
Can you tell us a little bit more, how did the German political and economic interests in the Ottoman Empire influence the response to the Armenian genocide?
So, in a way, it's the other way around. At some point, Germany was interested in forging closer ties to the Ottoman Empire. And it was a bit of a difficult process at the beginning. And then they discovered that the Armenian or the minority question wasn't only always the Armenians, also the Bulgarians, the Greeks, and other groups were easily exploitable by Germany. They could basically support the Ottomans against, you know, international outrage or even international measures of boycott or intervention, and instantly gain the goodwill of the Ottoman Empire. So, you know, Germany, like Italy, being a latecomer to the, you know, kind of power play, power game of Europe in the 19th century, discovered, you know, that there is an easy in with the Ottomans when it comes to the minority questions. So while, you know, Bismarck, you know, the founder of the modern German Empire, was a bit reluctant to get too involved in the Ottoman Empire and all the problems surrounding it, the Armenians didn't have a strong enough kind of international backer behind them at various points. So it was easy for the Germans to basically sell out the Armenians to get, for example, contracts in the Ottoman Empire or other, you know, economic advantages. And so basically over time, when in the 1890s, you had the years of massacres and pogroms against the Armenians, the, you know, Hamidian massacres, as they're often called, Germany, the leadership of Germany decided to stand with the Ottomans and was rewarded, amongst many other things, with the contract, the concession for the Baghdad Railway later on. And it's interesting to see, because behind closed doors, actually, there was a lot of outrage. And, you know, German leaders, the German emperor, for example, they knew that they were on the wrong side of history, that they should actually protect their fellow Christians in the Ottoman Empire. The Armenians, you know, had many different denominations, also Protestant, like, you know, the German emperor. But still, they stood by the Ottomans. The German emperor then, after the massacres are over, also travels to Constantinople and then also to Palestine, Damascus and such. They keep with this, and this is already, you know, over a decade, 15 years before the Armenian genocide even begins. So when, you know, World War I breaks out and the Germans try to understand what kind of role they're going to play in the Ottoman Empire, they decide early on they're not going to care too much about what is going on internally when it comes to minorities. And then later, you know, as it all escalates, you have this famous quote from the German chancellor at the time, which I have to paraphrase now, but basically all that matters for Germany is that the Ottomans stay at Germany's side in this war, and if the Armenians perish over that, so be it. So it's a very, and, you know, it's the same with my other research with Ataturk. It's a very functional kind of view on the Ottomans and later the Turks. It's mainly about what Germany wants and what Germany needs. But there is already criticism right from the 1890s, and it already focuses on, you know, this kind of dynamics, you know, humanitarian disasters or crimes against humanities, as it is called then during the Armenian genocide, and economic benefits. And it's interesting to see, you know, that already in the discussions in the 1890s, people critical of what's going on use a similar language to us today when we criticize, you know, big powers, you know, overlooking massacres and crimes or genocide, you know, in order for real political goals or for economic benefits. So there is a long line here, and this plays out already until the Armenian genocide happens, and then also until Germany debates the Armenian genocide in the 1920s. And I think these are crucial backgrounds to our 20th century world that we experience, that we might be still living in today.
The international community has become increasingly aware of the urgent need for genocide prevention in recent years. the devastating consequences of past genocides, such as the Holocaust, the Rwandan genocide, the Armenian genocide, and the atrocities committed in Bosnia, have underscored the importance of proactive measures to prevent such horrors from occurring again. From your perspective, what are some effective strategies or approaches to implement to prevent genocides from occurring in the first place? For instance, I cannot stop wondering what the future of Ukraine would be should Trump be elected president of the United States for the second time, as it was allegedly said he opposed aid for Ukraine, as the Sandys did.
So genocide prevention, this is something that will stick with us as something that we in academia and also practitioners have to constantly work on, refine, and adapt to varying conditions on the ground. So I think, like, removed from genocide occurring very soon or immediately is what we've been talking already about. It's acknowledgement that something like a genocide or a genocide happened, to as academics to work through these cases, to document them, to make them foolproof against denialist criticisms, and then also going into education. And I know you cannot always reach basically pre-genocide societies, but you can reach the rest of the world, perhaps. Be better in genocide education, be better at, you know, teaching students in schools and universities about, you know, what are the patterns here, how does this, how is this being prepared, to also forego essentialist kind of analyses, you know, like, ah, the Germans, they were all Nazis, they were all, you know, Jew haters anyway, or, you know, the Turks hated the Greeks, the Armenians, and so on anyway. That's too simplistic and doesn't really help. It actually obstructs more than it helps. And to monitor discourses, you know, discourses as they're being developed over time. So you mentioned Ukraine, you know, to have another closer look at what Putin has been saying in the last decades, what Erdogan is saying in the last decades, how these people are constructing the in and the out group, how they are constructing, you know, a national future, how they're viewing the national past, you know, what is operative here, you know, who are the enemies, how can we deal with them, you know, and all these different things, because they do prepare the ground for violence. And then there is another more global aspect of it, and that's that of impunity, you know, this idea that people can get away with murder and genocide. And, you know, as a historian, empirically speaking, yes, people can get away with murder and genocide, and that's really an ongoing problem for us. And I think, you know, because it's so difficult to solve, we've been kind of avoiding the topic for a long time, and we keep avoiding it. We do have, you know, instances now internationally. We have international courts for that. We have conventions and such. But as we all know, it's very, what do you say, limited still in scope. So, you know, these are important to set clear boundaries. And then, I mean, we have other problems. What is international intervention going to be like in the future? You know, when is the United Nations really operative? You know, when something is happening, when it isn't? And these are still very tricky questions. And it will depend a lot, as you mentioned in your comment and question, it will depend a lot on who is in charge in the, you know, at the helm of the most powerful nations on the planet. Yeah.
With the aim of preventing future atrocities and fostering reconciliation, the field of genocide studies continues to evolve, exploring new avenues of research and inquiry. From your academic and research point of view, what are some emerging trends or areas of focus within the field that you, a scholar of genocide studies, find particularly intriguing or promising?
So, as I mentioned already, discourse analysis, it's a bit of a boring field for a lot of academics and historians, but it's very important, you know, to understand the logics of how, you know, meaning is created. So a lot has been done there in the last decades, so that's very important for us and very good. History teaching also in combination with basically an academic or expert monitoring. How does history teaching work, you know, to kind of have a feedback with, you know, opinion polls, surveys, classroom visits, you know, how is actually genocide education or political education working, you know, in our various countries. And then for me, especially, there's been a lot of research in the last years on the economic aspects of genocide and genocidal violence, which I find always very interesting because there are economic benefits to people acting in this way on the ground, not only people higher up, elites or planners of genocide. I think of, you know, the special forces that the Nazis employed in occupied Poland, for example, that were able to loot their victims and send home trainloads of looted stuff to their families in Germany. I also think about the Ottoman Empire, where the term was abandoned properties, where we have a lot of interesting research now by my colleague Ümit Kurt, who looks at how it was organized, you know, how it was legally, but also practically organized, who benefited. These things are very important because sometimes, even though I mentioned discourses a lot, we get lost in this conflict. You know, they hated them because they killed them because, but there is a clear economic side to it all.
As we wrap up today's episode, we reflect on the invaluable insights shared by Professor Stefan Erik. While our discussion might seemingly be not of direct interest to Hellenism, we unrolled the blanket that has shaped our understanding of the late Ottoman Empire and the early days of the Republic of Turkey, and the threads that wove through the lives of Greeks during those times. The German support, often overlooked, emerges as a significant external factor influencing the fate of Greeks in that turbulent period. Through Professor Stefan Erik's research, we explored his perspectives on history and understanding the impact his work has had on the way we view the world. From Stefan Erik's enlightening discussion on genocide and the denial of genocide, to the exploration of illiberal democratic leaders within deficient leadership environments, his work has broadened our horizons. The fascination with totalitarian historical figures, as revealed in our conversation, adds another layer to the intricate fabric of a nation's founding principles. Concluding this episode, I'm excited to announce that the remaining part of our discussion with Professor Erik, focusing on the Pontic Greek genocide, will be released in the new year. Join us as we shine a light on these lesser explored aspects of history, delving deeper into the narratives that often escape mainstream attention. Make sure to follow the Global Greek Influence podcast so that you don't miss this upcoming episode as we continue our journey in the past to better understand present that demand our attention and remembrance. Thank you for joining us, and we look forward to bringing you more compelling content in the future.